Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I have the pleasure of talking to Donald Antrim, whose newest book of short stories, The Emerald Light in the Air, has recently been published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. It's a book of seven stories, all of which have been prominently featured in The New Yorker magazine, and five of which bear extraordinary relations to one another. And I found myself feeling that the center five stories in the book meant a huge amount to me. I just loved reading them. Their titles are Pond with Mud, Solace, Another Manhattan, He Knew, and Ever Since. And what I found extraordinary about them is that they feature a depressive at the center, trying to make do. The person is intelligent, witty, gentle, generous, sort of reminds me of Seymour Glass in the Salinger novels. And I realized that we're living in a time when our own suffering is so great that writers are not writing fiction about that sweet, gentle person. He was once a fixture on the American landscape. He was Elwood P. Dowd in the play Harvey. Somewhat alcoholic, used to be called manic depressive, now called bipolar. And I think that you, Donald, suddenly, after three novels of high comedy and a very profound memoir about your mother, you've turned to a new subject, which is how to live under the shadow of a disorder that most of us refuse to see or talk about now. Do you want to talk about it today?
Yeah, let's talk about it some. I never really felt that I was taking it up or would take it up or had taken it up entirely as a subject. It's more of a kind of a inevitability. You know, I wrote those novels, and there are breakdowns in them. But I had never, when I wrote those and for the first three or four books, I'd never really had any. I suffered anxiety and I suffered depression, but I'd never had a very serious time with it. And then after writing the memoir, which is a serious anxiety project and took a long time, I felt in a world of shame and a world of guilt for writing. My mother had died. And I began fairly quickly to write about her. And I hadn't wanted to. I hadn't thought I would. I hadn't planned to. I hadn't imagined that I would ever write a memoir. Once I began doing this thing, it became, as it were, what I was doing. And published the first four or five sections of it over a period of about three or four years, also in The New Yorker. During that time, my anxiety was growing and growing and growing. And at the end of it, you know, I was in a bit of, you know, down the rabbit hole. So now, after some years dealing with that, it's come into anything I'm doing. It's come into the writing in a different way. You know, so the characters that I look back on are the, you know, kind of comic situations in the novels. I see now that they're built around almost a kind of prophetic anticipation of something. And When that finally began to happen, when the conditions were right, or when the terms of living, were right, and I began to have a deeper and more difficult experience of it, and a more prolonged trip through psychiatry, fundamentally, it changed me. So in some way that I'm still trying to come to terms with, I feel that I see in everything I've written, I see these problems, or I see these concerns. My mother was a terrible alcoholic and a mortifying character to me, I mean, as a person. But she was my mother, you know. And mm-hmm. when I began to write this, I felt that I was violating, well, everything. Her dignity, mine. But then again, as I wrote it and as it went along, I also found that I was learning a different mother in some way. I mean, not one that I was inventing so much, but one I was in some way finding. I found that the mortification and the humiliation that I'd felt for years in knowing her and in being her son was shifting into a deeper respect for the way in which she had managed, in spite of all of her problems, to stay alive and to continue to work. As my perspective shifted on her and therefore on me and on my family and my origins, I think that I began to want to write something that was maybe a little less constructed out of conceit and moving toward not personal confession or testimony, but toward a more difficult to comprehend reality.
It's extraordinary, because what you've managed to do in these five stories, it seems to me, is to take us into the realm of the comedy of the specially sensitive. The character is, for instance, in Another Manhattan, buying the bouquet that's going to make him late for dinner with his girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
He's buying the bouquet to apologize for being late. And in fact, of course, this is the way it always happens. His credit card, he neither has enough cash, nor is there enough credit on his card, so he has to call his girlfriend to get her card number. And in the meantime,
it doesn't work, right?
It doesn't work either. Everyone is calling everyone's cell phone, including the wife's boyfriend.
Right.
It's an incredible mélange of contemporary life. And you see, the wonderful joke seems to be, we're all suffering. And it's light. It's not the end of the world.
Hmm.
We're all going to get to next week after this story is over. In fact, the characters are all going to go home together. It's sad. It's tough. It's crazy. And then the next story will begin. And these five stories have echoes of one another in them. So it's like a fantastic old-style situation comedy in which we get to spend time with our old friend, the imaginative depressive. How nice to see him again. Welcome. Pat him on the back. Oh, thank goodness he lasted since last week. Good for him. This is so hard. Now he's with his wife's son, and is taking him to the zoo. And who should he see in Grand Central Station? The boy's daddy playing the violin. The boy's daddy has lost his job at the conservatory. And now, what are we going to do? Oh, we're going to ask the boy's daddy, you want to have a drink? You're kind of a virtuoso of people who do exactly the wrong thing with the best motives at all. You know, all the good motives lead to the wrong behavior.
I hadn't, in writing, say, Another Manhattan, I hadn't had an idea that I would go toward a character who was suffering in the way that this character was. I'd been through a lot at that point. But I hadn't made a decision or hadn't felt that I would be comfortable in any way trying to write about it. And yet there it was. And so as the story went along, the stories don't proceed from an idea. They really proceed from a beginning point. And then it's a very slow process of waiting and writing and waiting and writing and going back. And it can take quite a long time. And so it wasn't until halfway through the story or so that I had a real sense that this is what it would be, you know. So then, you know, you see this again and again and again, and you have to go with it or not. You know, it's a matter of taking responsibility for something that's actually there, it's actually coming onto the page, and what are you going to do with it? My feeling is that what I'd like to do with it is actually try to articulate in fiction, as it were, and I don't mean didactically, I don't mean for some reason, but the physical experience of a depression that's going psychotic.
I'm talking to Donald Antrim about his very fine book of short stories, The Emerald Light in the Air. I think a story is a story, and it's a story about someone, and this someone is hurting, but has a gift of merriment, of joie de vivre, in the same way that people frequently say about alcoholics, oh, he's the life of the party.
Yeah.
And that mixture, to me, is more potent than a Manhattan.
Yeah. He drinks too much, but he's a great guy. In those novels that are told by the character who's causing the disruptions, those books also proceed from fantastic conceits. They're set out, they begin with either improbable or unlikely or fundamentally impossible situations.
Hey, Donald, let's name them. First came
Elect Mr. Robinson for a Better World.
Then came
The 100 Brothers.
And then the third was
The Verificationist, which is right. About a psychoanalyst. And you know, so all of that material, or whatever you want to call it, content or material, all that life, that part of life, was coming in a long time before I had any conscious awareness that it was going to come in a real way on me.
Well, you fooled me. You know, you were here. We spoke about each of these novels, I think.
Fooled you, yeah.
Yes, well, you did, because I would think, oh, well, they're comic novels about somewhat disquieting, unusual premises. Why in The Verificationist are we spending so much time in a pancake house? How did that happen? And I would be blinded to the disorientation,
right,
because it would be such a pleasant way of spending my time. I like pancakes. I mean, who doesn't?
I love writing them. They're quite a lot of fun. But I wasn't really, I don't think I was really fooling you so much as I didn't really know at the time what I was dealing with. It wasn't until later in life that I did at a certain point open one of them and see something there that seemed, I see writing in them, or I saw situations in them that seemed, much after the fact, after they've been written and published, they really seemed like good descriptions of what I was beginning to go through myself. So I didn't have a conscious or an anticipatory awareness of this, and I didn't really have a very sort of formed perspective on it. It simply was happening, it was coming through, I was working with it. Now, of course, I have a different set of problems and a different challenge, which is to actually try to describe very, very, what becomes after the fact almost a kind of an abstraction, but which in the life in that time in which a psychotic depression is going strongly, there's nothing abstract about it at all, you know. So that's been something I've been thinking about now for a number of years. How to do it. You know, how to describe that kind of, or how to write into that, as it were, And, you know, and also, you know, hang on to my head, you know, I mean, and, you know, take care of myself at the same time. But I think it'll be there is what I mean to say. I think it'll be in what gets written. And I think that I'll then have to work with it and see what I can do. And I've been doing that in stages. I'll just do it in stages over the next, you know, whatever, however long I have to keep working productively. And I think it'll probably be there sometimes and not at other times.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from KCRW. I'm talking with Donald Antrim about his new book, The Emerald Light in the Air, Stories. We'll continue after this short break.
If you're listening to Bookworm, chances are you're a big reader. Connect with other book lovers. Join our virtual book club on Facebook. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm for more info. Thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Donald Antrim about his new book, The Emerald Light in the Air, stories originally published in The New Yorker that display the humor and love that somehow rescues life's failures. Now, various people in the years between The Verificationist and The Emerald Light in the Air. We haven't seen each other since The Verificationist.
Now it's almost 15 years ago.
Yes. And people would say to me, oh, that figure in that novel was Donald Antrim. And I'd say, are you kidding? No, I didn't know that at all. No. Now, so there were people, in a sense, outing you as a depressive?
Well, that may have been, yeah. That may be.
It's so interesting to me because, of course, like many literary people, like many people who know how to read, I, too, have had my turn in the barrel, inevitably. And what amazes me is the number of people who want to tell stories on you, who don't understand.
You know more than I do.
I'm talking about people telling stories about me.
Oh, on you. Okay.
About
yeah.
Me.
All right. Okay. Sorry.
About
sorry.
Me.
You said story. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. On one.
On one.
Tell stories on one. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And I think, where is their empathy? Where is their compassion? Don't they know that this is around the worst thing that can happen to you in your life? The mind refusing to behave like a mind.
Well, I think that maybe the answer to the question is that the empathy doesn't exist. So if we're talking abstractly here, we're not talking about a specific situation or writer or whatever, but maybe it's possible that the empathy doesn't exist in that way because...
No, I'm talking about a specific culture, which seems to me to be American culture,
yeah, okay.
Which seems to have become extremely uncharitable
yeah.
About very common events in life that used to be common events in writing. The deep compassion and affection you show these characters is so pleasant to me that I felt like I was floating. I felt that I myself was receiving the charity that I needed to have years ago when my mind wasn't doing the things I needed it to. And I thought, oh, God, Donald Antrim has gone from writing this kind of old surrealist Dadaist comedy to this extraordinary generosity. Now, you're saying it traversed being generous to your mother, and then maybe you were able to be generous to yourself.
Well, I also had a lot of people help me stay alive, you know, and I was vulnerable for a long time, and I didn't think I was going to stay alive. I didn't think I'd make it. I didn't think I wouldn't kill myself. I thought I would. I don't know if I thought I would, but the state of being psychotically depressed or suicidally depressed is doesn't really allow for the idea that you're going to get through it. You know that you're going to be better one day. Better doesn't mean anything. Better just means something that you. That's its own abstraction at that point. It's something, in the way that one doesn't really, in some ways, remember the totality of depression. Inside that totality, it's very hard to remember actually ever having been able to function. I mean, you did, and you know it, but it seems like a joke was played on you, you know, and that you never really had. So,
God, you seem to have acquired a great deal of wisdom about this. Can you talk to me about the kind of compassion that goes into writing like this?
Well, I mean, you know, I started out hurting myself in order to write the memoir. And by hurting myself, I don't mean self-destructively. I just meant that it didn't feel good. And yet it was, you know, so challenging and so different to do. And I remember living inside, you know, a kind of a constant ambivalence. And the ambivalence in relation to writing that memoir was, I remember thinking that I would write it, and I would promise myself that I would just never show it to another person. And that's the only way I could do it. You know, I thought that if I were going to deal with what at the time would have been difficult for me to think about dealing with, was that I felt that in the end of her life, in the last years of her life, that I'd really just burned out and I wasn't showing up in the same way that I had when I'd been younger. And so I had to, you know, out myself with that.
The memoir is called?
The Afterlife, and it's not a comprehensive autobiography. It's a set of stories that came from our life together and from the life of my family and my family history. But inside that ambivalence, or with that ambivalence, I would also be aware in some way that I was going to publish it. So, you know, it's one or the other, and it's both. And I think now, having been through, I suppose you would say, the consequence, for me, the consequences of having written that, of having tried to write that very unpleasant but very engaging thing, you know, I just took on a lot of hell and certainly spent my years, you know. I like that expression, turn in the barrel. So it's like, so.
You know who said that to me?
Who?
Hugh Selby Jr.
Oh, that's great.
He said to me, we all get our turn in the barrel.
In the barrel, yeah. That's a good way of putting it. Because it is a turn, you know. You're really upside down. So now when I come to this, you know, I've had a lot of people help me stay alive. I've had a lot of people around me who helped get me through. I had doctors, I had nurses, I had friends. So I don't know. Maybe it has, you know, it's changed. Well, it's changed me in some ways. It's very hard for me to describe what that means, but I know that it's shifted my perspective, and I also know that it's given me a mandate in some way. And the mandate is not to avoid this, not to pull back from it, not to write about it necessarily, but to acknowledge, accommodate, and actually try to refine that.
Well, yes, now here we are at your fifth book, The Emerald Light in the Air. It's a book, as said, of seven stories published by Farrah, Straus, and Giroux. And I can tell you that it feels to me like a very well-balanced book. I don't know how you've attained it, but these stories are beautifully well-constructed. They end before their turning points, by and large. They end before tragedy comes. Mm-hmm. And they allow us to feel gentle and extraordinary, what I'd almost say is merry laughter. We know that something's really wrong. But for the moment, this is like Jimmy Stewart at his most congenial, affable, gentle, generous. I can't use good enough adjectives. The encasing stories, there's one about a wild production of Midsummer Night's Dream, including a blind puck, seem to be about chaos. The middle stories are about holding it together, but only just barely. And in the final story, all hell breaks loose, but in a way that says the imagination is the abettor of hell. That if you keep real, if you stay away from the zone of the first three novels you wrote, you will have truth rather than alienated comedy. And that is a lovely thing as well.
Yeah, thank you. I don't look. This collection has been. It was not conceived as a collection.
It's 15 years in the making.
17
isn't
years
it?
Or 18 years or something like that. They're one story every two and a half years, something like that. And they take a while to do, but still, I mean, it's not that many. So when I began, I didn't have a conception of a collection, or I didn't have and I wasn't writing a lot of stories, and I didn't really know what I was doing, and I had to learn to do it. But if they've come together in some way, if there seems to be overlap, and I think there probably is, then it's more unconscious. It has to be. You know, there was no plan, And writing stories, you know, that began it began a long time ago, and then I didn't do it for many years, but began again in a real way in the 1990s. That was a while ago now. So all of the things we're talking about when we talk about psychiatry, or if you talk about having a turn in the barrel, those things really came later. And so now the story is really sort of the kind of bookend the experience in some way, you know. So I like that. I feel like I can show those earlier stories and wonder if there might be, even though that not by design and certainly not by and through intention, there might be, you know, kind of an arc from somehow from the first to the last. And one that I think is a beginning arc. I don't think it's not a finished arc. I'm just getting going with this.
I've been talking with Donald Antrim, author of The Emerald Light in the Air, a book of stories published by Farrah, Straus & Giroux. Thank you, Donald, for joining me.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from The Emerald Light in the Air at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Subbing for her today is Alan Howard. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to assistant Jane Parshall. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
Read this, read that, read this, bookworm. Read this, read that, read this. I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.